It's a Sunday night in downtown La Crosse, Wisconsin. People are beginning to trickle into the Popcorn Tavern, a longtime live music bar. Tonight, it's Cuban Music Night. Time for another concert with the Cuban refugees who have made their homes in Wisconsin. To the right of the stage is a huge spread of food. Slow-cooked pork, plantains, rice and beans. And before people start filling their plates, there's a blessing.
So in the name of Jesus, I pray, you know, that he will bless the food and bless each and every one in here tonight. And in his name I pray, and I give him all the glory that he deserves, even only him. In Jesus' name I pray, amen. Thank you.
We want to eat, right? So let's go get it.
Once everyone's had a chance to eat, the musicians take the stage, and the crowd hits the dance floor. On stage, Rodosvaldo Pozo, or Nino, is playing percussion, his dreadlocks swaying with the music. Marcos Calderon is dressed in a flowing black and white polka dot shirt and playing the saxophone, which he just started teaching himself. And Ernesto Rodriguez is playing his signature bongos, one with a Cuban flag, the other with a Green Bay Packers helmet.
These Cuban exiles who arrived in Wisconsin in 1980 as part of the Mariel boat lift have become bandmates, friends, and family to one another.
And they're also deeply connected to their Midwestern hometowns. When they play live in downtown La Crosse, they bring together Cubans and welcome non-Cubans into their world, sharing their music and their stories. They are Wisconsinites. Ernie's bongos prove it.
But their hearts remain in Cuba. Now, these men are in their 60s, and they spent most of their lives in the United States. But they still want to visit their homeland one more time.
If they can find a way.
Soy Omar Granados.
And I'm Maureen McCollum. This is Uprooted from Wisconsin Public Radio.
In this episode, Going Home.
Or, for many of the Cuban Wisconsinites we've introduced you to in this podcast, whether they ever can go home.
My vision, number one vision, be able to one day visit my country and embrace my family and bring, you know, clothes and whatever they need, you know.
Osvaldo Durruti has a giant Cuban flag above his dining room table in Madison, Wisconsin. The country where he was born is always on his mind, even if he hasn't seen Cuba in more than 40 years.
I got my family waiting for me, you know, to come in. You know, my sister saying, my brother, you know, before I die, all I want is see you.
This is the last time you saw her, 1980?
No, I see my sister every in the phone every day.
Oh, that's nice. Go technology.
Thanks, technology.
Yeah.
Osvaldo talks with his sister and nieces and nephews in Santiago de Cuba regularly. He sends them money, but it's not the same as being together.
You know what the first thing I want to do? I want to embrace her and, you know, just raise her up, you know, and hug, give her the hug that, you know, nobody ever, she never get the hug from her, you know. And she say, what you're going to do is cook for me.
You want to go back and visit also?
Yeah, I want to go see my mama before she died, Gawin, and my family, you know.
Yeah.
Rosvaldo Pozo, or Nino, who lives in La Crosse, Wisconsin, also wants to visit Cuba. More than anything, he wants to see his mother, Isabel. She's in her 90s.
My mama loved me when they had a son until this day.
And then there's Nino's friend, Marcos Calderon, also of La Crosse. His first thought, it's also about family.
If I have the chance to go back home, you know, the person will be going to the cemetery where my mother's buried and giving my, you know.
His eyes fill with tears as he thinks about returning to Cuba and visiting his mother's grave. In the 40-plus years Marcos has lived in the United States, many of his family members in Cuba have died.
And my dad and one brother, they also passed away since I've been here. And giving my respect, you know, and thank you for the way they educate me, you know, before I come in here, and all the support that they're giving me in my life, and a lot of hard work to a place for food on the table so we all can eat, you know. We all cooperate.
For Marcos, the dream of returning home is maybe a bit more urgent than the others. He has bone cancer.
You say, oh my goodness, no, I'm going to die. But if you realize in your own brain, this is, I'm dying no matter what, with cancer or no cancer, I'm going to die someplace. So use that to help others. That's my intentions, okay? Because I'm trying to be happy, you know, I'm trying to do
that. It's his dying wish to go back to Cuba, to visit his home one more time.
Continue to say, going fishing, walking, this and that. So I know, but I want to pass on.
Many Cuban exiles are able to visit loved ones in Cuba once they become residents or citizens of the United States.
In comparison to other immigrant groups in the United States, Cubans have a much clearer path to permanent residency and citizenship thanks to the Cuban Adjustment Act.
This was signed into law in 1966. It provides Cubans with a streamlined way to obtain a green card and eventually become citizens.
Under this law, Cubans can become U.S. residents after physically being in the country for 1 year. You also have to prove you're Cuban through documentation and proof that you were admitted into the country by an immigration officer, someone who officially checks you in.
Omar, it seems like a clear and direct way for Cuban exiles to settle here.
Yeah, and this is exactly how I became a U.S. citizen under the Cuban Adjustment Act. I came to the United States under a visa and, you know, then applied for my green card a year later, and 5 years later, I became a U.S. citizen.
Under the Cuban Refugee Act, any Cuban coming to the United States was automatically granted refugee status, and with that, immediate medical, welfare, and financial aid.
There's another immigration law that's worth mentioning here, the Refugee Act of 1980. It offered a pathway for all refugees, not just Cubans, to become a permanent resident within 1 year. It raised the limit on how many refugees the U.S. would accept annually. It provided refugees with settlement and financial assistance, as well as job training and English language lessons. It also clarified that a refugee was a person with a well-founded fear of persecution.
Just 1 month after the Refugee Act became law, the Mariel boat lift was underway. Many of the Cubans arriving in Florida feared persecution from the Cuban government because of their political leanings, sexuality, or religion.
The Cuban Sea Lift has forced the U.S. government to choose between two politically sensitive policies. One is to offer a haven to anyone fleeing the Castro regime. The other is to restrict the entry of foreigners into the country who might displace American workers from their jobs.
However, the Mariel boat lift brought so many Cubans to the United States in such a short time that the U.S. would have hit its annual refugee admission limit, established by the Refugee Act of 1980, in a matter of weeks.
To make bad matters worse, no one in the administration or elsewhere will even begin to predict how many more refugees may be on their way here.
And Cubans weren't the only people from the Caribbean coming in large numbers to the U.S. in 1980 because of political repression.
While Cuba has provided the bulk of the recent surge of refugees, Haiti is also producing thousands seeking asylum in the U.S. But in order not to appear to be treating the two groups differently, the president recently declared that all refugees, Cubans, Haitians, and others, are to be treated the same.
So in June of 1980, the United States government responded with a Cuban-Haitian entrance program. Lumping these two groups together in one policy immediately solidified the racializing of this situation.
So the INS is granting temporary parole status with work permits to those arriving.
The official designation for the Cubans and Haitians was entrant with status pending.
Last night, State Department officials lifted the limit on the number of Cubans who would be allowed to stay here. And they said that people coming in from Cuba now will be considered, quote, applicants for asylum, not refugees.
And this really derailed things for the Cuban exiles.
So this was sort of a limbo status that they had to keep that did not allow them to adjust under the Cuban Adjustment Act.
That's Miami Herald staff columnist Fabiola Santiago,
who covered the Mariel boat lift and its impact in Florida for many years.
And so for 5 years, they were completely statusless. They couldn't buy a house. They couldn't travel. They really were like undocumented, except that they were not subject to deportation.
These Cubans didn't get the benefits that other refugees had gotten, including other Cuban immigrants under the Cuban Adjustment Act and the Refugee Act of 1980. This limbo status meant that they didn't have a clear path to becoming permanent residents or citizens.
Fabiola says lawmakers finally addressed the issue after stories about the Cubans stuck in limbo became more widespread.
I did a piece that featured a pianist who could not go give a concert in Bogota and an artist who could not, again, exhibit in Mexico City. You know, these stories started to come out and pressure was put by Miami's growing political structure. And eventually then they were allowed to begin, you know, the process of getting residency, which then led to citizenship and things normalized.
That process of becoming lawful permanent residents or green card holders started around 1984. That meant they could live in the U.S. indefinitely. They could own property, get financial aid for higher education, and join the U.S. military. It could also lead to becoming citizens, which would mean they could vote and get a U.S. passport.
So when their parole status as entrants ended and they became eligible to adjust their status, they still had to apply.
Unfortunately, a lot of the Mariel folks did not do that in a timely fashion.
That's Steve Laxton.
I am an immigration attorney with Matuzik Laxton and Davis Law Firm in Sparta, Wisconsin.
Steve is a rarity. There aren't many immigration attorneys in Wisconsin, especially outside of Milwaukee and Madison. He says in a lot of cases, Mariel refugees in Wisconsin who could have gotten their immigration status changed just didn't fill out paperwork.
I think a lot of people thought, well, you know, they let me in, end of story. And there was a lot more to it, as there usually is in immigration law processes. And a lot of people didn't really have much guidance from anyone either. You know, they maybe had a sponsor for a brief period of time, and then were kind of on their own and didn't have a lot of, systems of support.
Steve actually became an immigration attorney because of the Mariel boat lift. He worked in a kitchen at Fort McCoy in 1980 while Cuban refugees were living there.
I started developing interest, I guess, in the Spanish language and then also in Latin American affairs to some degree. Through a series of events, I ended up where I am today, I guess.
In fact, it was his buddy Joe Brandstetter who convinced him to get a job at Fort McCoy. The same Joe that became friends with Ernesto Rodriguez and convinced his parents to sponsor Erne and three other Cubans.
So, besides confusion surrounding the immigration paperwork, there's something else holding some Cubans back from becoming U.S. residents or citizens. Remember those drug convictions some of them faced?
A lot of the cases we see now are, you know, the people that come to me, you know, they have that problem. They didn't attain the residence when they could have, and then they ran into criminal law problems.
Yes, if you commit a felony in the United States, that can stay with you for a long time. Even if you're a citizen. In some states, you lose the right to vote. In some, you cannot carry a firearm or get a visa to travel to certain countries. Since some of the guys we've talked about on this podcast were convicted of felonies for selling drugs, they're not eligible for citizenship.
The only exception under the immigration law is for the use of 30 grams or less of marijuana for your own personal use. So any other type of drug offense is just lethal under the immigration law. There's no waiver available. There's not really too much you can do about it other than maybe seeking post-conviction relief on the criminal law side to try to change it into something else or find some legal defects in the procedure. But otherwise, if the conviction stands, you've really got a problem on the immigration law side.
The only way these Cuban Wisconsinites could become citizens is if their convictions were overturned, the charges were amended, or they received pardons.
Remember, most of these guys were convicted of drug crimes 30 to 40 years ago.
You know, I think it goes back to the war on drugs and just the political opinions about drug use. You've certainly seen a liberalization of that at the state law level in recent years where, you know, a number of states have decriminalized or legalized at least the use of marijuana. But there's been nothing that's happened on the immigration law on that side.
Marijuana is legal in many states now, but not in Wisconsin. And nationally, the laws have not changed for other drugs, ones that some of the Cuban Wisconsinites were caught with decades ago.
If it was cocaine, let's just use that example, then if the person was seeking resident status, then unless you could get the charge completely thrown out, there would be no amount you could change the facts into, so to speak, to help that person.
Not only that, they're at risk of deportation.
If you have a drug conviction, particularly, let's say, a drug trafficking conviction, that's going to result in you being put into deportation proceedings if you're not a U.S. citizen. And a lot of guys received deportation orders.
Yeah, some of the guys we've been talking with on this podcast have deportation orders that are still in effect. Enrique Moray, from the first episode, and Nino have been held in immigration detention centers in Milwaukee and Chicago for months.
Nino says he was detained when he went to renew his work permit a few years ago. He says he was in immigration detention for about 6 months.
I got deported. They took me to Chicago and deported me to Cuba, but Cuba didn't accept nobody.
Cuba wouldn't take him back. They don't allow people with felony convictions back into the country to stay or even just to visit. Even if Nino wanted to go, Cuba would not accept him. So even though he was released from the detention center and able to return to La Crosse, he could still be detained or deported at any point. It makes Nino uneasy, to say the least.
I'm paying taxes, so why are you gonna, you know, keep me in limbo? You're gonna put me in jail for no reason. I no have committed no more crime. They don't have given me a due process right to the Constitution, United States 14th Amendment. And I say it's a cruel and unusual punishment, a minimum violation.
And there isn't much clarity from the government on what's going on. We've reached out to various federal agencies, like the State Department, U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, Department of Homeland Security, and we can't get answers to any of these issues. So how is the U.S. able to detain people like Nino for months on end? There is a 2001 Supreme Court case that ruled people cannot be held indefinitely, even if they're being deported. They have to be released after 90 days. Attorney Steve Laxton says there is an exception.
Unless there was a significant likelihood that the deportation could be executed, then the person had to essentially be released. And they set up a process where there'd be review at 6 month intervals. Well, if you've gone through that review process and you've been released, then they give you work authorization, sort of a suspension of deportation status. You're still legally deported. They can't effectuate the deportation, so you're kind of in a limbo.
They can continue to live in the United States and get a work permit and driver's license, but they could still be deported at any time. Like if the U.S. and Cuba improved their diplomatic relationship.
Earlier this year, spring of 2022, the two governments actually met to talk about this very issue, on whether Cuba will start accepting more deportees. But it doesn't appear that much has changed yet. All right, Omar, so a lot of the Cuban Wisconsinites we've talked with on this podcast are living in the U.S., but they cannot become U.S. citizens.
Yes, that's correct. And they don't feel like it's fair since they pay taxes. They pay an annual fee for a work permit, which keeps going up. It's $410 now. They receive Social Security benefits. They have driver licenses. And they regret their past decisions. They feel like they paid for the past crimes, but the charges stick with them.
Like a dream. Just like all the people come out here to live the American dream, and they're still searching for that dream.
That's Marcos Calderon of La Crosse.
We be here, we pay tax, we work, you know, but we have no rights at all. And we just pretty much stuck in here without having the opportunity to become an American citizen or a resident. Some of us have become a resident, those who hasn't committed crime. And it's very sad because sometimes we live in a state for nervous because you don't know if something is going to happen and we all immigration coming in and lack all the Cubans they are under deportation. And you just don't know. For no reason, for no particular reason. And now punishes for probably over 27, 28 years since I got released.
Marcos was convicted of a drug charge in 1988 in Minnesota, something that has impacted his life ever since.
1991, I got out, and since then, all I have done is work, and no crime, nothing, and no second chance.
And Marcos wants a second chance, mostly so he can go visit Cuba one more time.
But to do that, he would need a passport. Without a passport, you can't leave, and you cannot get back in. But he can't get one, since he's not a U.S. citizen.
But wait, I hear about Cubans traveling back to the island.
Well, yeah, some of the Cubans who are not U.S. citizens are able to travel with a green card and a Cuban passport. But for the most part, these guys don't have any of these documents.
Why can those Cubans get a second chance? So they can go see the mama, because we have been abiding citizens since that we committed the crime, you know?
That's Nino, who was caught with cocaine in the early 1990s.
I believe it. It's the immigration.
Yeah.
You see, are we willing to take a chance and look and say, why those people are still in limbo for 40 years, even though they pay taxes here?
I remember the past, you know, we've been, you know, committing a lot of crime. We were, you know, doing a lot of wrong thing. But, you know, everybody had done wrong in life, man.
And that's Osvaldo Durruti, who was sent to prison after selling cocaine to an undercover police officer in the early 1990s.
But, you know, even though that it's been 40 years, you know, we're not perfect. We just want to, you know, be part of American dream, you know.
Omar, what about that American dream? Is it even available to these guys?
Well, they all still want it desperately. They've been chasing their vision of the American dream since they left Cuba in 1980. I'm just not sure their American dream even exists anymore. Lilian Guerra says access to the American dream has a lot to do with race. She's an author and professor of Cuban and Caribbean history at the University of Florida.
These cases of people who are desperate to return speak to how traumatic their lives have been here, and how inconsistent their knowledge of the United States is. I mean, many people think that they believe the American dream exists, and they don't understand that the American dream only existed for those who were white and who were born of Americans who were also white, you know, or those who could be considered sort of invitees to this kind of Anglo-Saxon American dream. You know, Italian Americans and Irish Americans got to be part of that dream in the 1950s, precisely because of the rise of unions and the legalization of union rights. And they became workers with middle class kinds of living standards and income. But blacks weren't part of that, and Afro-Americans weren't part of that, and Puerto Ricans weren't part of that, and Latinos in general were not, unless they managed to come with a certain degree of accumulated historical advantages, like my family did. You could have been penniless, but if you had, you know, a medical degree, you knew how a system worked and how to get ahead in a new one, you know?
Coming up, one of the Cuban Wisconsinites could see his dream come true. This is Uprooted from Wisconsin Public Radio.
Secret meetings, deleted documents, and a case that went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. The story behind Wisconsin's electoral maps is anything but boring. Hi, I'm Bridget Bowden, co-host of WPR Report's Mapped Out. It's an investigative podcast that gives you the lowdown on Wisconsin's redistricting past and what it means for its legislative future. Get the whole story and subscribe at WPR.org/mappedout or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Maureen McCollum. Thanks for joining me and my co-host, Omar Granados, on WPR Reports Uprooted. I'm honored to explore the historical account of thousands of Cubans who came to Wisconsin during the Mariel boatlift and interview exiles who have decided to share their stories. WPR is member-supported. That means your gift makes powerful storytelling, like we're hearing today, available to you and the entire state. Support this essential resource at WPR.org/donate.
Well, we can iron out those details later.
Let me shut this because that was my seat in Cuba.
Oh, you can answer it.
Just as Omar and I are about to start an interview with a few Cuban exiles who live in La Crosse, a phone rings. Ernesto Rodriguez is getting a video call on WhatsApp from his older sister in Cuba.
Estoy en una reunión.
Sí, sí, yo creo que se recibiste la dirección.
Sí, ya lo recibí.
Erne tells his sister, Caridad, that he's in a meeting. Then Omar tells her that her brother Erne is going to be famous on the radio in Wisconsin.
Muy bien, muy bien. Aquí estamos grabando una entrevista con el hombre que se va a hacer famoso en el radio de Wisconsin.
Erne introduces Caridad to everyone sitting around the table. Niño, Marcos, Maureen, and me.
They haven't seen each other in person in nearly 50 years, since he was in prison before hopping a boat to come to the U.S. during the Mariel boatlift. After a few minutes, Erne tells Caridad he'll call her back later.
Ciao.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
I didn't know.
This is how a lot of the Cubans stay in touch with their family, through video calls. It's one of the only ways they can stay connected to home, a place where they haven't been in more than 40 years.
Do you want to go back and visit?
Of course I want to go to this. I have a lot of family that I never met before, like niece, nephews, great-niece, great-nephews. Anytime I talk to them, it's, when you going to come? When you going to come?
On this episode, we've talked about how people like Marcos, Nino, and Osvaldo can't go back to Cuba because of mistakes they've made in their past.
I have a little situation, different than them. Uh-huh. I can go to Cuba.
Oh, you can?
Yeah, I can go. Because I was lucky. I never commit a crime. And my paper is clean.
That's right. Erne can go home. He's a permanent resident of the United States. He's had his green card since 1981. His sponsor family, the Brandstetters of Sparta, helped him fill out the paperwork. Then a friend drove him to Milwaukee to get it. Because Erne has his green card, that opens the doors to traveling back to Cuba.
Well, the first thing I'm going to do is go to my hometown.
From the airport in Havana to Camagüey.
Camagüey, I go. My brother going to come to get me, and me and my brother, we're going to my hometown.
Road trip.
Erne wants to go check out a massive sugar mill he used to work at and see if it's still up and running. He also wants to visit his grandmother's grave and just walk around his old neighborhood to see where people live.
See if I recognize where I used to live, see if the house is still there. And then I go to Florida, spend the time with my family in Florida. Mm-hmm. And then I go to Havana, party in Havana.
Yeah.
Everybody go to Havana.
Of course.
Start partying in Havana and play music.
Yeah,
and,
man, all night.
Eat.
Roast my house, pig.
What do you want to eat?
Roast pig. Dig a hole in the ground.
Uh-huh.
Put a coal. Wood in there.
Boom, coal.
And put a steak inside that pig. And put a concrete inside.
Hallelujah.
But, and of course there's a but, Erne can't go just yet.
The only problem is when I want to do my passport, I talk with my family to send them my birth certificate. And when I see my birth certificate, they have a little problem.
Erne's name on his birth certificate does not match his Cuban ID. The name he thought he had his whole life is Ernesto Rodriguez Ruiz, but his dad signed a different name on his birth certificate.
Yes, his Cuban birth certificate says Nestor Rodriguez Cruz. And who knows what happened there? Maybe someone just heard his father wrong.
And when I see my birth certificate, that's wrong. That's not my name. And then I don't want to change my name.
All Erne has to do is legally change his name in the U.S. to what's on his Cuban birth certificate, Nestor Rodriguez Cruz, and then he can go back.
Yeah, but Erne doesn't want to change his name. The lawyer, Steve Laxton, who's been working with Erne, has told him to change his name and he won't do it. This is a source of contention among his Cuban friends. They don't understand why he won't just change his name. They say they would change their names in an instant if it meant they could go back to Cuba.
What a unique scenario.
Yeah, this is what's so fascinating to me about Ernest's story. He really, really, really wants to go back to Cuba. You can tell from how much he's already planned out and what he wants to do there once he gets back. But changing his name is the one line he's not going to cross to do it. It's his identity. He doesn't want to become someone else in the United States just to go back to Cuba.
But Erne and the others still feel like there's a path for them to return to Cuba, even after 40-plus years. They're now trying to clear some of the obstacles on that path.
Yes, in the time that I've known them, I've seen them gain much more consciousness about their situation and the ways in which they were discriminated as refugees. They've organized, they're counting on each other more, and their involvement with our podcast and the traveling exhibit that we had have really helped them feel like someone is finally listening to them and they've decided to stick together and advocate for themselves.
I'm 63 years old. Wow, times go fast, you know? And I haven't given up. I have faith. If I go back to Cuba,
Marcos has plans to meet with Wisconsin Governor Tony Evers' staff to share his story. He's talked about organizing rallies to bring attention to the Mariel refugees situation. He's explored the possibility of asking for a pardon in Minnesota, where he committed his crime. Nino talks about doing the same in Wisconsin. As of August 2022, Evers has issued 603 pardons, more than any other Wisconsin governor.
So we can do some kind of letter to the government here, the Senate, to see if we can be able to enlist for humanitarian reasons, be able to see our mama.
More than anything, Marcos wants to become a U.S. citizen. It's not just to go back to Cuba. He wants to vote. He wants to travel the world. That's his lifelong dream.
Enough is enough, okay? Enough is enough for people that pretty much has been in this country more than they have been in their own country. You know, this is our case in here. And I want, you know, the law to change. I want people to hear a voice. I want people to know that we are legal in the United States of America. We were welcome into this country, you know. We just not swim over. I just wanted to get together a group of people, you know, if it could be a march, a very, you know, calm march, to ask or to somebody to see our cases. With the amount of families that we have, we, the Marielitos today, since we've been here, kids, grandkids, great-great-grandkids, because some of us have it, well, not some of them have it, you know. It will be a humongous amount of people that they're gonna see we are going up there and support those guys, you know, because enough is enough, you know. Yeah, they committed a crime, they were young, and they didn't were exactly know what they were doing the majority of the time. They were trying to survive.
Go ahead.
I don't even know what I was now.
And then there's Osvaldo Durruti of Madison. 30 years ago, he thought the only way he could go back to Cuba was by killing Jeffrey Dahmer and getting deported. His mindset has changed a lot since then.
As me and my Cuban guys, if we don't come together and try to ask him for, you know, forgiveness, we never gonna be heard, because, you know, all we got is our voices, and we want our voices to be heard. We want our voices to conquer, you know, what we've been seeking for years and years and years, because, you know, this is the land of opportunities.
Osvaldo is asking for another chance.
Especially since he's turned his life around. He started over.
But, you know, we pay for our mistake, you know, 20 years, you know, 30 years, most of us didn't penitentiary. We are all, we're on the 60s, you know, so, you know, we are not a threat to society anymore. Most of us, you know, we got our, you know, family, we got a job, we do everything except being crime maker. And, you know, whoever listened to us, we just want, you know, to ask for forgiveness, ask for, you know, consideration, asking for, you know, opportunity to, you know, grow as a man, as a father, as a husband, as a mother, whatever, you know, family you got, you know, we got.
They all closely watch what's going on with the Biden administration, like when the president granted clemency to some drug offenders in spring of 2022. They were really excited to talk about this when it happened.
And like many people, they keep waiting to see if the Biden administration will push to normalize relations with Cuba.
The Cuban Wisconsinites keep tabs on a lot of Cuban news, as well as what's going on with undocumented immigrants and Latin American migration. But so far, there haven't been many signs that lawmakers or government agencies are looking to change their situations. Even when working on this story, none of the government agencies we contacted for this podcast would even comment.
For as much as they want to go back to Cuba, these men really want to stay in Wisconsin. Remember, they've lived most of their lives here. As hard as things have been, most of them really love it here. They have kids, friends, girlfriends, a band. They don't want to be deported.
Omar, you have been able to go back to Cuba multiple times. I'm curious how you feel when you hear the guys talking about wanting to go home.
I have, and I'm always very careful to not say things like, I had a great time, or I ate this, or I saw that. And they always ask me all the time what I did and what I ate when I was on the island.
So are you trying not to hurt their feelings, or is this something you're doing to protect yourself?
Both. And the issue is that Cuba isn't really home for any of us anymore. In one way or the other, we are all living in limbo. And of course, I can't compare my situation to those who can go back home, but it is the curse for many of us who have left Cuba, because everyone in Cuba is gone. All friends, family, people from our generation have also left the island.
So the Cubans in Wisconsin that we've been talking with, they left more than 40 years ago. Would they even recognize Cuba?
They might recognize some of the buildings and, you know, their neighborhoods, but the Cuba that these guys remember just doesn't exist anymore. They're living in a nostalgic memory from 42 years ago. They keep up with Cuban affairs a lot more than me, and I'm a researcher of Cuba, but I choose to protect myself from that since it can be very heavy for me. What they have is an untouched memory of the Cuba of the 1980s that they left.
Is that why you think they still dream of home?
I think it's unfinished business. I go back home and I say, wow, everyone is gone. And then my fantasies are erased. But that hasn't happened to them. They haven't experienced the frustration and the disappointment like I have. but that might just be me. Going back for one final moment to settle the score, going back for one more hug, one more visit, especially when they know that the end of their lives is approaching. They want answers, and they want to get that chance to say goodbye to the loved ones. To not get that chance is very hard.
So there's no big dramatic ending here. No one has gone back to Cuba. They're all still waiting.
In the meantime, I'm continuing to work with the Cuban refugee community in La Crosse to help them tell the stories. We're doing that through the Uprooted Traveling exhibit and very soon a virtual exhibit.
And stay tuned. If there are any big updates in the lives of the Cuban Wisconsinites, like if someone makes it back to Cuba, we will bring you their stories. As for the people you've met on this podcast, Ernesto Rodriguez's papers to return home are still not in order. In La Crosse, he's gotten really involved in a Latin dance group.
Rodosvaldo Pozo, or Niño, continues to play percussion with La Crosse musicians and loves watching Cuban boxing online.
Marcos Calderon is still teaching himself the saxophone, and he's still fired up to change things politically. He's also been talking more publicly about his cancer diagnosis, hoping to inspire people to push on through their own treatments.
Armando Rodriguez is living in Madison, and he's driving a forklift. He often drives to La Crosse to see his friends.
Enrique Morey, who likes to play music too much, just wrapped up another recording session with his band, Mr. Blink. And then there's Osvaldo Durruti. He says he hopes one day he opens his mailbox and finds a letter from immigration saying he's a lawful permanent resident of the United States. Then he could go home to Cuba one more time, a dream that hasn't always felt within reach.
Osvaldo became his neighborhood laundryman as a young child, turned to pickpocketing to feed his family, got sent to Cuban prison under Castro.
He was shipped off to the United States as part of the Mariel boatlift, sent to live on a military base in Wisconsin, sponsored by a millionaire in Nashville.
He survived multiple gunshot wounds, got arrested and sent to prison in Wisconsin, got out and started his life over.
Through all of it, Osvaldo has always persisted. He's never given up. And today, he believes his dream of returning home to Cuba will come true.
I hope that happens, you know, so you know how to keep pushing and pushing and pushing and pushing. It's all we're looking for, you know.
Yeah.
With that being said, you know, hopefully, you know, one day, you know, you guys remember us and give us the opportunity to, you know, that we need. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Osvaldo.
God bless America.
Uprooted is reported, written, and produced by me, executive producer Maureen McCollum, along with Omar Granados. Our producer and technical director is Brad Kohlberg. We're edited by Brady Carlson. Music direction and composition by Carl Christensen. Additional support from Adam Friedrich, Peter Bryant, Hannah Haynes, and Ezra Wall. Digital editing by Alyssa Alamand. The digital design team is Jane Jumale, Amanda Starich, and Anna Rudin. Digital direction by David Hyland. Photography by Angela Major, and special thanks to the University of Wisconsin-La Crosse's Murphy Library for archival photos. Artwork by Grace Lorenz. Our theme music is the song Bozo Part 3 by Willie Chirino. Archival audio from NPR's Research, Archives, and Data Strategy team. You can see more at wpr.org/uprooted.